After lunch, we milled around and shook each other's hands. At one point, I wandered over to the window to take another look at Harvard. I felt a tap on my shoulder. When I turned, I was shocked to see George Rich's ancient and weather-beaten face smiling kindly at me. Next to Hall, he was considered the most powerful man at Maine. "Presidents come and go," my boss Bruno Zambotti had once told me. "But Hall and Rich are always there, pulling the strings." George Rich had been sitting at a nearby table with a couple of other men. "Quite a view," he said. "Got a moment? Can you come to my office?" Chapter 34. Egypt. Controlling Africa. I could not believe my good fortune. First, lunch with Mac Hall and a group of top executives. Now, an invitation from a man who was truly a living legend in the engineering profession. I had heard many stories about George Rich's exploits in Africa and the Middle East. He was one of the first to venture into remote areas and develop hydroelectric sites for rural towns. He had traveled down the Congo River back in the days when it was still Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. Rumor had it that he had trudged across deserts with Lawrence of Arabia. Now, late in life, I had been informed that he was 84. He was held in the highest esteem by engineers from around the globe. I had discovered that mentioning his name to the heads of companies in Bogota and Tehran would win invitations to home-cooked meals in their homes, something practically unheard of among Iranians. He was also one of the founding partners of Yule, Hall & Rich, an engineering firm that had been created by Maine's CEO and his two closest associates to do work that, for reasons no one ever satisfactorily explained to me, could not be accomplished by Maine itself. I had been told that the laws of New York State required such a company. But my hunch, and it was just a hunch, was that it had been set up to conduct more clandestine activities, or perhaps to help its three principals launder money, their own, and that of wealthy clients and government organizations. I followed George Rich out of the restaurant. However, we did not go to his office. Instead, after taking the elevator down to the floor where Maine's executive offices were located, we headed along the corridor to the boardroom. He produced a key and ushered me inside. "Changed my mind," he said, motioning for me to sit in one of the plush chairs. "I think this place is a bit more private than my office." He turned his back and strolled over to a display on the wall. It was centered around a lighted map of the world, with a parabolic shadow that moved across it, indicating where day became night. I had been admitted to this room once before to study this map. Mac Hall's private secretary had unlocked the door and stood discreetly to the side as I determined what time I would have to rouse myself that night to make a telephone call to Bangkok. Rich pointed at the top of the African continent. "Egypt." He turned to face me. "I know you just got the cheerleader version from that AID guy. Now, I want to make sure you know the real story. I understand you're pretty sharp, got the true picture of what we do. You'll be going to Egypt soon and then to Kuwait, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia." He let this sink in, fully aware, I was certain, of the thrill the names of these countries and the knowledge that I would visit them inspired in me. "You know, of course, that our job is much bigger than what it appears, what the contracts state." He leaned forward and stared at me. "Right?" "Yes, sir, I fully understand." "Good. I've never been knighted. I'm no sir. My name's George." I could only smile, wondering whether I would ever be able to call him that to his face. "Okay," I said. He tapped the map with his knuckles. "You've been informed about the Muslim Brotherhood?" "Yes." "Well, they're very dangerous. Must be won over, compromised, bought out, destroyed, whatever. Because they can't be stopped. Sadat proved that. You go after them and they just gain more support. Like throwing kerosene on a fire." He pulled the chair up in front of mine and stood behind it, facing me. "But that's not your job. Not now, at least." He sat down so close our knees nearly touched. Look at that map. He pointed. What do you see? I was confused. Egypt, you mean? Of course Egypt, but where is it? Where's Egypt? He patted my knee. Get up there and take a good look. I did. On the Mediterranean and Red Seas, next door to Israel. He gave a sigh. What continent? Africa. Yes, the light flashes on. He reached above his head and made the motions of a man pulling a string. Yes, indeed, Africa. Take another look at that map. Contrary to what most Americans seem to think, Egypt's an African country. Is it part of the Middle East? Sure. The Middle East isn't a continent. Middle country. A rope that ties Europe and Asia. And contrary to public opinion, Egypt ties both of them to Africa. Now let me ask you a really tough one. Does Egypt have a river? The Nile. Right. And what can you tell me from that map about the Nile River? It runs through Sudan, which, until 1956, was part of Egypt. It was granted independence by the British, of all things, by the Brits and the Egyptians. However, many Egyptians are still pissed off about that. They consider that huge piece of real estate theirs. Where else does the Nile go? Well, if you include both branches of the Nile, Lake Tanganyika and those other smaller lakes, it covers a good share of the continent. Aha! Welcome to the land of Dr. Livingston, I presume. One more question. If you get this one right, you can come back here and sit down again. What direction does the Nile flow? North. Bravo! So, what you're saying is that a great deal of the African continent drains into the Nile, and the Nile flows into Egypt, right? Good. Then can we surmise that the fertile floodplain where the pharaohs built their pyramids contains the silt, the topsoil, the heart and soul, if you will, of a great portion of Africa? That Cairo is built on African soil, not just because it sits on the African continent, but because it sits on soil that originates in the lands south of it. Right you are. Come, rest yourself here again. I took my seat and waited for him to continue. He just sat there staring at me. I tried to choose my words carefully, aware that this man could make or break my career. I understand what you're saying. Egypt may play an important role in the Arab world, but it also has an impact on Africa. I glanced back at the map. It's a bridge, from both a geographic and a social perspective, also economically and ethnically. He continued to stare. I had missed something. And, of course, religion, too. Very good. He stood up, clasped his hands behind his back, and wandered over to the map again. Egypt, Sudan, Ethiopia, Somalia, Kenya. These are all ancient lands interconnected through the threads of history, not to be taken lightly. The Greek historian Herodotus sang their praises in the 5th century BC. Legend has it that the Ethiopian monarchy, today's Emperor Haile Selassie, was founded by the son of Israel's King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. This entire region is an amazing place, not to be taken lightly. He shook his head solemnly. No, sir, not to be taken lightly at all. He stared at the map for another long moment. Then he came back to me. You know, there's one hell of a lot of oil in that region, too. I'm certain of it. I've spent a lifetime studying geology, and I can tell you that during your life, Africa will become a battleground over oil. He sat down. So go ahead and mind the words of Mr. USAID. Go off to Egypt and use it as a staging ground for subjugating the Middle East. And also, recognize what few people are talking about today. It's the staging ground for Africa, too. And if you ever intend to have children and want them to live prosperous lives, you damn well better make sure that we control the African continent. We need the Middle East, yes, but we must have Africa, too. Walking out of that boardroom, I felt elated. During a few short hours, I had attended a meeting with Maine's CEO and a senior U.S. aid officer, and I had been singled out by George Rich. I had never before thought about the fact that Egypt was part of Africa as well as the Middle East, or that it performed such a significant function in geopolitics. I was certain that few Americans were privy to this perspective. I felt like a man on a mission, who had been initiated into an exclusive club. I rode the elevator to the ground floor and began to walk across the Prudential Center toward the building that housed my office, the Southeast Tower, 101 Huntington Avenue. Perhaps, I thought, Rich's last comment was the key. Someday I would raise a family. I peered through the window of an upscale clothing store at a male mannequin wearing a pinstripe suit. I promised to return later in the week and purchase that suit. The decision to do so liberated me. I told myself that George Rich, the venerable engineer, was right. We had to take control of countries with resources our corporations wanted for the sake of future generations. I bought that suit, and within weeks, I stepped onto a plane headed for Egypt. Chapter 35. Infidel Dog. During my times in Cairo and Alexandria, I grew increasingly frustrated by the lack of cooperation from local officials. I had been hired by USAID to develop economic forecasts, which would be used by the Egyptian government to procure World Bank financing. To do my job properly, I needed detailed population statistics for specific regions of the country. Although I knew they existed, I was told by one bureaucrat after another that the information was not available for public consumption. I kept pointing out that I was not the public, that I was working for them in the strictest confidence, and that I had to obtain those statistics if they expected me to compile a report that would ultimately bring billions of dollars into their country. This sort of appeal-cum-threat had worked for me in Asia and Latin America. However, it seemed to have no impact in Egypt. The officials in Cairo and Alexandria who were assigned as my counterparts, and therefore were supposed to expedite my work, showed me around their cities. We visited spice markets and smoky cafes where turban-wrapped men played dominoes and puffed on bubbling hookahs, strolled along the Nile and the Mediterranean, gawked at precious jewels and priceless antiquities in ancient palaces, and consumed gallons of tea. But whenever I reminded them that I was waiting for the population statistics, they reiterated the difficulties while soliciting my patience. "Things take a great deal of time here," they would say. Or, "This is not like America. We are a very old country. Camels walk slowly." When I offered to bribe them, legally of course, by paying excessive amounts for people to work overtime, with the officials pocketing the difference, they merely shook their heads and offered me another cup of tea. Finally, in utter frustration, I decided to go above my counterparts' heads. It was a drastic step, one I had always avoided before because of the risk of antagonizing people I relied on, but this was a situation that had turned desperate. I arranged a meeting with a man at the top of the government, someone who had served in several ministries and now was a personal advisor to President Sadat. He had a long formal name, but I was told to simply refer to him as Dr. Asim. He had graduated from Harvard Business School, was intimately familiar with organizations like the World Bank and USAID, and had a reputation for getting things done. For my part, I understood that his assistance would not be cheap. I was prepared to bribe him generously. I was delivered to a modern high-rise office building and then escorted by a burly security officer into an elevator and to the top floor. A dour-faced, tall, thin Egyptian man in a black suit showed us into a tiny room with a couple of couches, and in perfect, British-accented English, informed us that there would be a very short wait. The security officer, who spoke no English, sat down across from me. We waited. I read an old copy of Time from a pile of magazines on the table between our couches. The security officer dozed. I read in National Geographic. We waited for nearly 2 hours. Tea was never offered. There was no doubt in my mind that Dr. Asim was serving notice of his importance, and, judging from the lack of tea, his displeasure that I would try to bypass the normal channels. Although seething, I prepared myself to offer an even bigger bribe. At last, the tall, thin Egyptian reappeared. Without apologies, he ushered me down a long corridor to a massive wooden door that would have suited King Tut's tomb far better than this contemporary building. He opened it. I was shocked by the vastness of the room. It was opulent enough to please the most egotistic pharaoh. Decorated in a combination of ancient Egyptian and modern Park Avenue. Antique papyrus scrolls vied with Picasso vases. Modern designer furniture rested on Persian carpets. Dr. Asim was hunched over a colossal desk, dressed in a dark blue suit and gold tie. His face was pudgy and soft, like a melon. He wore wire-rimmed spectacles, the kind I associate with Benjamin Franklin. He did not bother to look up when I walked in. The tall, thin man bowed out. I stood near the doorway, waiting as the doctor apparently finished some paperwork. Finally, he raised his eyes. "Sit," he said, indicating a chair in front of his desk, and then returned to his work. I felt confused and slighted. I might have transgressed, but this was overkill. Had he forgotten that I represented a prestigious consulting firm hired to help his country? After what felt to me like a very long time, he straightened and peered at me over the tops of his glasses. He seemed to measure me as one might an insect caught scurrying across the dinner table. Then, in an effort that appeared to summon all his energy, he reached across his desk and held out his hand. I had to stand to shake it. My confusion turned to anger. I suppressed it and forced a smile. Trying to adhere to local etiquette, I thanked him profusely for agreeing to meet with me. He ignored my niceties and, without the exchange of greetings that are customary in Egypt, bluntly asked me what I wanted. There could be no doubt that a polished diplomat was insulting me. Openly, flagrantly. I was tempted to walk out. Instead, I took myself back to the Engineers Club, atop Boston's Prudential Tower, and then to George Rich in Maine's boardroom. Suddenly, I felt vindicated. My revenge for his insolence was the knowledge that I was an EHM on assignment to exploit him and his country. I could suffer his little victories, knowing that my side would win the big one. This battle might be his, but the war would be mine. I relaxed into my chair and my smile turned genuine. Population data.
I beg your pardon.
I need population data. I explained my dilemma in the briefest language. So you see, I ended, unless your people cooperate with me, your country won't get all that money your president is requesting. He slammed his fist down on his desk and stood up. His girth reflected that of his office. His chair rolled back across the floor until it bumped against the wall.
"I don't give a damn about your billions," he said,
his voice surprisingly low and controlled, given the histrionics of his actions.
"Young man, for you can't be as old as my youngest son, what gives you the right to march in here and make demands?"
He waved a spongy hand to forestall my answer.
"Let me tell you a thing or two. I've lived in your country. I know all about your fancy cities, cars, and homes. I know what you think of us."
Placing his hands on his desk, he leaned across it and glared at me.
"Do you know how many people at Harvard asked me if I rode a camel?"
"At Harvard?"
"Amazing your stupidity. The myopia of your country. We Egyptians have been around thousands of years, tens of thousands. We will be around when all of you are dust."
He retrieved his chair and sat back down, emitting a loud sigh as he did so, and turned his attention once again to the papers on his desk. I sat there staring at him, forcing myself to recall those moments in the boardroom. I also journeyed back to meetings in Indonesia where, because I spoke their language and my hosts did not realize it, I overheard government officials denigrating me, while smiling politely and offering me their finest teas. I steeled myself. I would beat him at his game. Eventually, he looked at me across the tops of those spectacles. He waved me away.
Go.
But he slammed his fist down once again. This time he remained seated.
Always remember, he said with that disorienting calm. You are an infidel dog.
His eyes held mine, unflinching, a trait from Harvard, I supposed.
Infidel dog.
He spoke the words excruciatingly slowly.
Now, go. You'll get your population data if Sadat and Allah will it.